Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Coffee and Open Source, a place to meet some new friends, have some great conversations, and maybe learn something along the way. I'm your host, Isaac Levin, and if you're enjoying the interviews here, be sure to like, subscribe, follow wherever you're watching or listening. Also, if you're interested or know somebody that'd be interested in coming on chatting with me, feel free to reach me out on Twitter. My handle there is Isaac R. Levin, or you can reach out to me on Mastodon. My handle there is IsaacR11@faustin.org. All right, so without the way, I'm looking forward to it. I've been a fan of this individual for a while, and I'm just looking forward to learning a bit more about them. So my guest today is Anwan Simmons. Anwan, do you want to say hello, introduce yourself?
Hello, Isaac. I'm Anwan Simmons. To those of you watching, I'm so happy to be with you today. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about like what your life is? Like technology translator is like kind of the way you kind of market yourself. Like, I want to get into that a little bit. But first I want to know, like, when technology started for you. Like, do you remember a particular time when technology was just, hey, Anwan, this is us, technology. Do you want to hang out? And you're like, yes, all day long. Or like, you know, depending on where you're, like, when you started your journey, like, people kind of have different, like, I guess, starting points. Like mine, for instance, was like Web 2.0. So like MySpace pages was like kind of like the introduction to tech. Like, do you remember when tech kind of introduced itself to you?
Yes. So I am a typical nerd, right? I was that fourth, fifth grader reading Tolkien, Lords of the Rings.
Oh, yeah.
The Dragons with my friends. By the way, Ranger class is the best class. And I was, you know, chaotic, good Ranger. But I was that kid, and growing up in North Texas, in Wichita Falls, Texas, that's where I'm from, I was that kid that was into gadgets and tech, and I don't think I had a name for it. I just knew that it was cool, and I remember going to a garage sale with my mom. Not a garage sale. It was a flea market, because my mom is this kind of collector. She would collect, like, Coca-Cola products and bottles, and saw a Commodore 64. At this flea market, and I paid whatever it was for it, brought it home, plugged it into the CRT monitor, I think it's a black and white TV that we had at the time, and just learned how to use basic, right? So Lodestar, *8, 1 is burned into my memory,
because
that's how you write games. And I remember just falling in love with this little box that I could do cool stuff with. And I went from playing games. I was very much an RPG player. Ultima with Lord British, for those of you who played that kind of game when you were young. Ultima 4, Quest of the Avatar, by the way, best RPG ever. And so I grew up doing this. And I think that the Commodore 64 was very much my gateway experience into tech. And then I later got a Commodore 128, and I remember learning more about coding and writing in BASIC. And I remember there was, I want to say, I think it was called Computer Shopper, or I forget what the magazine was, but they would have programs in it that you would have to type by hand and get them running. And I remember finding a bug in one and like writing the magazine and saying, hey, I found the bug here. And then that led to other things. I think that if we're going to get into going toward college, so I was an electrical engineering major at the University of Texas at Austin. And I tell people that if I back away from deciding to be a double E major at UT, you know, very difficult major, I trace it back to really eighth or ninth grade, because I was a big Star Trek The Next Generation fan. And I remember Geordi LaForge was the chief engineer of the Enterprise. I don't think he was that role first season, but from season two until on, he was a person who exemplified technology and figuring things out. And this is another example of why representation matters, because LeVar Burton played that character so well. So I could see myself as a technologist. And while there were other factors, that very much led me to be double E, to get my degree, to start working in software development. So that's my origin story.
Man, that's, so there's a lot to unpack there. But I gotta ask, like, I gotta ask the most pressing question for me. Like, Age of Empires, like, was that the thing? Was that your thing? Because Age of Empires, I remember, like, viscerally, like, playing it nonstop when I was, I don't even remember how old I was. Like I was a teen or whatever. Like, so did you get into like those sort of games too as you got older? And then obviously like the StarCrafts and the Warcraft, like the original Warcrafts, right? Or did you kind of like, I don't want to say grew out of gaming, but did you very much like realize you enjoy the technology side of gaming more than like the playing games part of gaming?
Great question. So I know about Age of Empires was not necessarily a big fan. I was more like Ultima.
Yep,
I mean, even before, I try to remember the order. So Zork, does anybody remember like their text-based games was all text and you would type in. And so I forget the name of the company, but they had Zork 1, Zork 2. They did a text-based version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is my nerd, right? And that led me into, you know, I think in college, I got into multi-user dungeons. Remember MUDs? I don't know. I'm probably dating myself.
No. Like
text-based, like, and so.
So you're into the text-based stuff more than like, I guess the,
I mean, I really didn't mind like, you know, very, you know, what we would call maybe 1980s, you know, 16x16, whatever graphics, however the, you know, size was. I do think though that because when I got to UT and was an engineering major, I did feel I needed to kind of let that go a little bit. And so I did outgrow it a little bit, and I had to I maybe step back a little bit more. So TSR, who did Dungeons and Dragons, did a variety of games. Pool of Radiance was one, all based on the D&D system. This is way before Baldur's Gate, right? I'm talking like this is this is Baldur's Gate's great grandfather. And so that was probably the height of my gaming. But I do think that once I got to college, and then definitely once I started working, so Accenture was my first job from college. Yeah. And then I was like, okay, all right, I got to focus on doing this work thing. Yeah. But like very much like my childhood was very much wrapped around those types of fantasy adventures types of things, right? So that was very much like the heart of my initial take into not just tech, but the whole kind of tech nerd, Greek or geek, you know, sector.
I'm curious to, you know, in the not to delve way far out into the ether, but I because you do see like a ton of overlap in the tech culture, like as people that are in technology for trade and for work, and like the geek nerd culture, like the people like you're saying that they like to play tabletop games, or they like to they play games like Magic the Gathering or, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, or they're into things like anime or things that I guess you would classify like in the geek or nerd culture. And I'm curious to know, like, what you, like, as somebody who, I imagine you probably still play a little bit of Dungeons and Dragons or tabletop games or whatever, right? Like, what do you think it is specifically about that sort of area of interests that align with people in technology so much?
That's a great question, because I can tell you that along my career, and I've been doing this for a long time, I started... Again, to date myself, I started at Anderson Consulting, now known as
Accenture.
So this is before the whole rename, in 1997. And I can tell you that along my career, my ability to be fluent in geek, meaning Dungeons and Dragons, anime, I remember watching Akira, Record of Lodoss War, Bubblegum Crisis, these are all Japanese animation
titles.
You know, I mean, this is again the grandfather to Naruto, whatever.
Naruto,
Right. So, but I think my theory is that when you are a bit on the fringe of what's considered cool in high school, right? So, you know, I wasn't a jock, I wasn't athlete, I wasn't whatever the different categories are.
Yeah,
I wasn't really with the goth kids and all that. But very much I felt drawn to computers. And so I was in computer club in high school, and very much that very much aligned with that culture, people who were into sci-fi, fantasy, Dungeons and Dragons. That I honestly think that a big part of that world of sci-fi, fantasy, anime, et cetera, is like the imagination.
Yeah,
and I think that like a critical part of being a software developer is imagination, right? You have to be, you have to be willing to take this prompt or take this syntax or take this code and be like, I'm going to make it do something, right? Yeah. And I'm going to write it in whatever language you're using. I'm going to imagine what it can do. And I think that kids that very much early on were drawn to Tolkien and D&D had that power of the imagination, which led them to be like, okay, writing code is like writing my imagination. And I think that this, that's kind of why people tend to be similarly interested in that kind of narrow set of, of area, because it's all like imagination power. Like you have to have a good imagination to be able to be successful as a software developer.
It is quite interesting. Again, like you said, so many things I want to drill into. Like I'm like we were talking a little bit before we started. I scribble some notes what you're saying. So if I have like seven things in my notes already, so we're in trouble.
Okay.
So it is interesting, and I don't know if you pay attention now to like what the new generation is, right? Like people, but now you see like that counterculture, but you see like that geek culture, that nerd culture, so prevalent in like actual mainstream pop culture. And I wonder if it's because people relate more to being a bit different now. Because when we were kids, like, I don't know if we're the same age or not, but we're close enough in age to, for this to work. Like that you did, you have like groups, you have cliques, right? And everybody that wasn't in like a clique kind of was on the outside. But there's always this feeling of like, you felt a bit unique because you didn't fit into those cliques. Now I feel like kids today are so more self-aware of who they are that they're okay with identifying as not typical or not inside of some particular box. And I'm curious to know, like, do you think that that's an evolutionary thing? Or do you think that that's people just having so much more information in their face that they have more context to decide who they want to be? And I know that's way out there from a question perspective, but I'm generally curious as your thoughts as somebody who is, you know, you've been in this space and you've watched this stuff for so long, like, and there's obviously been this trend, right?
Totally. I think geek has become chic, right? I think that a lot of the world that I lived in very much was in these very narrowly defined buckets of what's normal, what's acceptable. But I think with the advent of the internet, the world is just so much bigger. I think that with just the ability to be able to learn about different places. I mean, I remember my parents bought the Encyclopedia Britannica when I was in like third or fourth grade. And I would read that thing.
You like, read it, right?
I would get like, absolutely. And I think that with Wikipedia and with other technologies, the world seems more reachable and you can go beyond. Maybe you're brought up in a big city, maybe you're brought up in the countryside, but the world is a lot more at your fingertips than it was definitely when I was growing up. And I think that that means that people are used to being into different things that are not mainstream. So I think that with the advent definitely of media and movies, and I always say that like kids today, like so many of the things that I was into that only nerds were into are now like everyone loves it, right? So Game of Thrones, Game of Thrones was my dream in the 1980s and 90s. Sure. You didn't have the technology. We didn't have the animation capabilities and the CGI, right? Yeah. So like I suffered through the horrible sci-fi movies in the 80s and 90s.
Oh,
I
remember They're great. Like really bad 80s sci-fi movies, man. Like... Chef's kiss,
I mean,
right?
Remember, like they did, like the Fantastic Four. They tried things in that time, and it was just like not great. And so, we now live in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We now have Game of Thrones. We have all these things that are way more high fidelity than like I went through when I was in my 20s. And so, I think the advent of just the improvement in what you can show on a picture and on a screen, and the access to information means that people are like, yeah, I am into these things. I may think that the opening of the world, right? So like I didn't really leave America until maybe my like 20s. And so and over time I've been able to go to places like Tokyo. I mean, I've actually been lucky to be all over the world. I was in Australia maybe like a month ago. But I think that just the ability to like get out of your own little bucket and realize that there's so many cool things out there that people are free to find their kind of niche. Yeah. And you know, like the saying says, like the saying goes, there's riches in niches, and people are able to enrich their world and their life and their lifestyle with what they're into. And I think that that's why this generation, like being different is like almost like being like everyone else. You can have your thing. Like, that's cool.
It's wild to me because I'm a big, I love baseball. And like, you'll see these younger players that are like in their early 20s and they're all like anime fans, regardless of like where they're from. Like, you know, in like the best player for like the Seattle Mariners, which is where I'm from, is, his name's Julio Rodriguez. He's like 23. He's amazing. And it's like, you ask him like what his favorite thing to do, like when he's not doing baseball, it's like, oh, I watch anime. And he's a 6'4", 230 pound kid from the Dominican Republic who likes anime, which is like, it's just absolutely wild to me. And like, you hear this more and more, like if you watch the NBA, you'll see people with, you know, going way outside of like the traditional like fashion choices, right? Like people are like, it's just so interesting. And, you know, what you said something a bit earlier that, you know, I want to science this a little bit. Like you talked a little bit about writing code and self-expression and like how you can relate like things like D&D, right? Like I've said this 1,000 times on the show. So apologize to everybody that's listening because it's, you know, it's kind of a rant. Like people talk about, you know, nerds or people in tech, like being very left side of brain, right? Very analytical, you know, ones and zeros, all that sort of stuff. And right side of your brain, people more, you know, artistic, free expression, what have you, right? And I say, like, tell me that writing code isn't art. Like, and I'd love to get your thoughts, right? Like, if somebody had that is, you know, you have like this, I mean, I'll just say it, like, you have a very active imagination to be able to play things like D&D. I never got into D&D because I couldn't understand how people were able to just create these amazing worlds with a piece of paper and a dice. And like, I just couldn't, like my brain was just not formed or evolved enough to be able to get that. So I'd like to kind of get your thoughts on like, you know, creative expression and tech, like, and how you can kind of mold those two things together.
Yeah, that's a great point. I would say with D&D, having a good dungeon master, right? A good DM.
Sure.
Which like I was never that great at, but I had some good DMs that like they're very much part of creating those worlds that's just like it's paper and dice, right? Maybe a pen and pencil there. I think that I agree that we've gone away from the very narrow view of software developers or even like nerds and geeks into a more inclusive world. I think that I know software developers who are bodybuilders, who are hardcore snowboarders, who are into all kinds of things. They play in bands. And I think that as software developers became more ubiquitous, right? Because and I see it in my career, software becoming just the way that you build companies, that like every company has software. And so as there was a market for software developers, there was a market for software engineers. And I think that we cast a wider net.
Yeah.
And by doing that, we begin to bring other people into this field. And I think people found that, okay, I can write code and walk in my imagination and also draw from different parts of my life, whether maybe that is just classic nerd stuff like, you know, anime or D&D or comic books or whatever, or it could be like, you know, I'm not into that at all. I like rock climbing. And, and I really think that our industry, as this demand for software developers brought in people who were beyond the stereotypes, we got more enriched experiences. And I think that those perspectives meant that we write better software. Yeah. I think that as people came into the industry and found that it's a welcoming place, that we got better backgrounds, right? I mean, some of my right-hand developers, so I've been an inch manager for a long time, and some of my best tech leads, the people who were like the people on the team who were there to help me navigate some of the more gnarly parts of the code base or whatever, some of them had backgrounds in speech pathology or they worked for book publishing companies, right? Some of them did not have a traditional computer science degree. They were either self-taught or they went to like Flatiron or to like a boot camp, and like fantastic engineers. And I think that like that's a credit to our industry. We're not fully there yet, to be honest, but I think that by casting a wide net and by opening the doors to everyone and for people who were interested in solving problems in code, and we didn't care like what that talent was wrapped in or what it looked like, we've gotten a better industry. And I think that the degree to which we are able to keep those doors open, we'll have better software written because of it. So I think that that's been a part of, like, it's been a slow process, but I've been happy to see it. Even over my career, we are way more welcoming, and I think we have better developers. And I think that people found, again, the opportunity to operate their imagination at work through writing code. And I think that that's brought in people from all kinds of disciplines and walks of life, and we are better for it.
No, I completely agree. Like, you said something too, like when we were talking about, like, when you got started, right? You were talking about, like, seeing LeVar Burton's character, Jordy, right? Like, and the, I'll just say it, like, for folks that are growing up that are in underrepresented groups, and they see folks like you, or they see folks like Angie or Kelsey, or like these folks that look more like them than I do, right? Like, it really brings perspective into, I have the ability to do these things. I can actually be successful doing these things. I just need the access, right? I just need the path. And I'd love to, you know, circle, like, I want to fly way back to, you said UT Austin and doing electrical engineering work, right? I know a ton of people that started off in, I guess, the more practical engineering track when they were in college. And for whatever reason, they enjoyed the software part of engineering a bit more. Was there a particular point in time that you remember when you're like, okay, like, I love building things, and engineering is the enablement of building things, right? But I really like the software side of it. Like, was there a particular class? Was there a conversation you had? Like, I'm just trying to get a little bit of insight as to, like, what triggered you to go down the path? Because, like, one is abstract, right? Writing software is abstract, versus one is more practical, right? Electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, like, those are practical engineering tracks, right? I'd love to kind of get your thoughts on, like, or, you know, if you remember exactly when that change occurred for you.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, great question. I think that I've always loved building physical things, right? Again, I was that kid that built model airplanes, right? And so there was a brand called Snaptite, where you could just take the plastic off the little mold and snap things together. But then you had the more advanced one where you would have to have cement. Like, you have to, like, put the cement, you would glue things together, and then you would paint them. And so I grew up building F4 Phantom, F15 or F15 Tomcat Falcon, what I forget what the models were. But I think, but, like, I was just drawn to this. I don't know why. I would go to the store and buy these model kits with hundreds of pieces. This is, I guess, the precursor to my introduction to, like, Legos, and just build physical things. I enjoyed building physical things. So I get to this, you know, electrical engineering major where I'm taking, like, VHDL, which is a language for, like, programming circuits. And I'm learning about, you know, obviously, like, resistors and conductors and transistors and all that stuff. And I'm building things physically. And I enjoyed that. But I think that because a lot of my coursework was very much around learning languages. So I took data structures in C. I forget now, but I think that I was more drawn to the fact that it's just, ones and zeros are just lighter, right? That when you want to build something, it's so much easier to build them with atoms and bits than wires and transistors. And while I enjoy both parts, I just felt that, again, maybe my imagination felt more unleashed with the coding courses that I took. And it just, as a practical matter, as I got toward my last year, I was thinking, okay, I can be, like, a certified engineer and go out and work for Intel or AMD or whatever chip companies were hiring back then. Or I can talk to these analytic consulting folks. And I met people in the class before who did this, because during that time, Anderson Consulting very much hired people from the business school. Yeah. But again, being the 90s, they realized that we needed people who could write code. And so they had a technology practice, right? And they would come to the engineering school for that. And I really found that learning about what they did and seeing, okay, I can use my software development skills to create solutions for people began to be way more exciting to me than just sitting in the lab somewhere, you know, fabricating circuits. Yeah. And I think that I've always, or maybe not always, but, like, that began my journey of being someone who wanted to operate at the intersection of business and technology. And I found that working for Anderson Consulting at the time very much was having to work in those worlds. And so that probably led me to get my MBA later in life as well, because I wanted to have the ability to marry both. And I think that that's kind of why I went away from the more physical, tactile part of my degree with more like building processors to like the more maybe abstract, but more people-centered part. And like to this day, like that jazzes me. The people part of software is what gets me going every day. That's what makes me feel like I want to go to work and help people, not necessarily even write code or support people who write code, but it's helping people, whether that's our customers, the engineers that I'm tasked with supporting, my colleagues. I'm very much jazzed by the people side of all this.
I can't agree more. That like that's why I'm in tech as well. I want to get into a little bit about the people and technology intersection, but I got to ask this since you were talking about it. Like you were talking about building models, right? Like, do you get into Gungam much? Did you get into like building models like that? Like the anime models, like with, did you get into that with the painting and all of that? Or did you kind of stay away?
I don't know if that was even like a thing back then, right? I'm talking my model airplane, and I'm even do model tanks and model cars. This is probably the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. And so I think that part of anime came later, right? And so my anime, just to date myself again, like you during this time, you couldn't go to Blockbuster and get like a VHS.
Sure.
You had to go to the weird bookstore.
First off, you just said Blockbuster and VHS tape. So like you, what is this? You know, what is this? Yeah.
But like that's, and again, going back to like the availability is so much better. Like I had to go to the weird bookstore in Austin, in someone's basement, and like get my anime titles, and I would you know, get the VHS to take it back to my dorm and play it in my VCR and all that. And so just like the accessibility. And so I actually didn't know about these kind of like building mecha and building, you know, back then my thing was like Robotech. That came later. I mean, maybe it was available, but it didn't come to where I was. So but if it was available, I absolutely would have did that for sure.
Yeah. You like, I mean, the fact that it didn't get to you probably saved you tons of money, right? Like, So, you know, you mentioned that you got started, like your first job out of college was at Accenture. Well, Anderson Consulting, you know, for folks that are curious, look up the history of Anderson Consulting. It's pretty wild. So what, like one of my, the jobs in my career is I worked at Avanade, which is kind of like
y'all were new to me, right?
A Microsoft, like for folks that don't know, like Avanade is like the Microsoft technology implementation arm of Accenture in a lot of scenarios. Like they do their own business, but a lot of it is through Accenture. Random question. When you got started, did they have like the Anderson School yet? Where they send you up to Chicago and you were in that that old women's dorm? Yeah. So like
I went to St. Charles.
Yeah. I just remember that being so wild. Like so you have like the story is they bought like an old, like all women's like university, and that's where they did all their training, because they could basically isolate everybody into one area. Like there was a bar, like restaurant, like that was very, very close, and like meeting rooms and all of that. And I just like, that was my entry into like consulting. And I'm like, this is wild. Because, you know, like, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, like consultants have a bad rap for like and have a good time. So your first job is consulting, right?
Yeah.
I want to know what that experience is like, because for folks that don't have consulting experience, like there's a lot of stuff you have to juggle. It's not just as simple as like, here's some work, do it. Like a lot of times, and I don't know if you were doing the traveling 4 days a week, like 4 days. Oh, no. Yeah. Right. Like that's a whole thing. So you're living in motels and you're living in airports, and you're, you know, you spend 1 day a week at home, and like you're talking to this person, no offense to people that have MBAs, people that have MBAs that think they're smarter than you. Like
I have an MBA, I understand.
Yeah. Like I'd love to get your thoughts on that experience, especially for somebody fresh out of college.
Yeah. So I will say that someone fresh out of college, and that was me, being a consultant was an amazing opportunity because I learned so much in those first few years that I think in any other industry would have taken me maybe 2x, 3x the time to learn. So yes, I joined Accenture November 7th, 1997, to date myself again, in the Houston office. I think whatever, 1 or 2 weeks later, I'm flying to St. Charles to go to join my start group, right? Which were other people who've started with you. And so you fly to St. Charles, and it's not just people from like North America. We had people from the Philippines, people from Europe. If as someone had never been out of the country, it was amazing meeting people from Germany, from the UK, from you know, China, and they wanted to show that like Anderson Worldwide is worldwide. We can bring the best talent from all over the world. And so you're learning, and we took, you know, we did this, I forget what the language was, but there is this project to learn to write code. And so my particular thing was called Siebel, which was a customer relationship management or CRM tool. Oracle bought Siebel. I mean, now it's been a long time ago, but Oracle made a different product. So I was like a Siebel person.
Yeah.
If you think about SAP or like Oracle enterprise products, it's very much an enterprise product. But that's when I learned how to work with software. And so you just described my life, right? In that if I was lucky, I could leave Monday morning and come back Thursday night.
Yeah.
But often it was you leave Sunday night and come back Friday night. And so you had a very short period of time at home. And so I say that as a 22, whatever age I was, 23-year-old person, having to understand the technology part of my job, having to understand the client, because these client engagements might be 4 months, 5 months, 6 months long, and then you're on to the next one. And so you're constantly learning about what does this client need? What parts of the software do they want to use? What kind of out of the box, because these are all kind of consumer off the shelf or COTS products where you kind of buy it in a box and then you can customize it. Like, okay, what's, what out of the box do they need? Okay, what do we need to do to, you know, to do custom, or, you know, do we need to do anything just purely, they can't use C, but we got to write something up for them. I learned about requirements gathering. I learned about working with business analysts. And so my understanding of technology from the very beginning was, it's not just code, right? Code is not enough. It's what do people need? How do we test this? How do we make sure that the people who use this already, because Accenture had a, we called it, when I started, it was called change management. I think they changed it to human performance later on. But basically, how do we take this very complicated system that's replacing probably spreadsheets and help the people use it, right? And so it's the whole story around the code. And so that's very much aligned with operating at the intersection of technology and business.
Yeah.
And so I would say as a young person, especially out of college, you are in this amazing crucible of having to learn things quickly, having to constantly adopt to adapt. And, you know, Accenture was very much up or out, right? I mean, it was very hard to stay employed at Accenture because, I mean, it's a very tough kind of environment. But if you're able to do it, you are so well served. And I think that you can go from Accenture to anywhere. But I will say that it was the travel that began to help me see I really cannot do this very long, because along the way, like, I got married. We've been married at this for 22 years, but like year 2, 3 of marriage is tough, then kids came along. So I realized that this traveling thing, it was an amazing experience, but my consulting time had to come to a close. And that really led me down the path of going through startups, who we can talk about later. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, I would definitely say if you're young, especially if you're single with no children, you can make it work otherwise, but especially if you're single with no children, it's an amazing way to spend a few years in that powerful, powerful crucible, because you have to learn so much and grow so quick, but you're so much better at the end of it.
Yeah. I want to get into a little bit. You said something that literally brought back some nostalgia. You said Siebel. Like, one of my first jobs was like working on Oracle ECM, which is like what Siebel got renamed to. So so I'm like, I was like, oh, like Siebel, I don't think I've heard that
name. I've ever heard of.
Yeah. I don't think I've heard that product name in like 15 years. That's pretty wild.
Right, and for people who are Googling, it's S-I-E-B-E-L. That's how you spell Siebel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it was at the point in time where like every company, like every big tech company was like, I got to build an enterprise management system, right? Like Microsoft had one, SAP you mentioned, and then Oracle was like, we'll just buy like a fairly well-known one, right? That's what Oracle does. One thing too, like as somebody who did the traveling for a bit, like you get very spoiled with the traveling. Oh. With the per diem, with like the getting status for hotels and airports, like, and then like once it stops, it's very, very hard to like go back. Like I remember vividly, like going to an airport and like, like having to sit in the normal part of the plane, not the front part of the plane. You go to the hotel and the person isn't like, oh, here's your upgrade, right? Like not getting those things. And like, you build a bit of privilege because you just expect them for so long. Random question. Are you able to, it's been a while since you've like done it consistently.
Yeah.
Do you still miss like just all of the perks of being like a business traveler?
So
not to say that you would trade all the great things that have happened to you since then, but like, do you miss it a little bit?
So do I miss the perks of travel? So just to explain, like I went all the way up to Platinum on Continental Airlines before it became United. Most either gold or platinum or whatever on most of the major hotels. I was more of like a Marriott person, but got pretty high with like Hilton properties. So to explain what we're talking about missing, yes, getting access to the lounge at the top with the free snacks and all the nice drinks, getting access to the airport lounges, like all of that came with that travel. And, the first year you spend not doing that, like all that slowly goes away. Mm-hmm. And and it's not just getting access to like maybe a nicer car from Hertz or National, or just getting those more regular upgrades to first class, just because, hey, you were far enough ahead of
the queue. Status,
right, with the status. But I mentioned I went to Tokyo. Like at the age of 23, 24, I went to Tokyo, Manila in the Philippines, and Hong Kong and Bangkok on points. It was free flight, free hotel. I just had to show up and like figure out food, right?
Yeah.
Because I had so many points and I could just fund that kind of trip just because I wanted to go. So, so I miss the enjoyment, but like I don't miss what it took to get there, right? Because like I would rather, with my family of five, my wife and our three kids, we're sitting in coach. Maybe we're in like the nice part of coach these days, but like I'd rather spend time with them. And like maybe and these days, if I get that random upgrade, I'm like, hey, my wife, you go sit in first class. Like I've sat in first class so many times. I would like you to go up and I'll just sit here with with the kids. So I very much get like my utility function is more like being with the people I care about, even if it's in coach, rather than like being myself in first class.
Oh yeah. Like I'm a full subscriber to, if you're traveling and you get upgraded, like the spouse gets the upgrade. Yeah, like, so we have 8 and 6 year olds and my wife is like, are you sure? I'm like, you're gonna sit back here with these animals, like instead of going sitting up front with the breakfast and getting all the good stuff. Like, no, like just, I can handle these kids for a 3-hour flight. Like, don't worry about it. So eventually you kind of led into this a little bit. Like eventually, like you got burnt out of consulting, which it does happen. Not to say everybody gets burnt out of consulting, but like once you start to like settle down as an individual with family and other obligations, like it becomes very, very hard to be gone 4 or 5 days a week. When you decided to kind of transition away from consulting and into a different area of tech, like what were some of the things that you were looking for, if you remember?
So like my spouse and I decision. So it was a family decision. My solution was to get an MBA. And so I left the picture and like, look, I'm going to get off the road. I'll get a break. Our kids were probably, I mean, that's far from your kids' age now, like maybe 4 or 5 years old. I can spend more time with them. I mean, I'm getting an MBA, but like nowhere near the travel requirement, right? Sure. I'm driving to do my thing, not flying to do my thing. And I got my MBA over like a 2-year period. And that was what we did, right? And so I was able to get off the road, spend lots of an amazing time with my kids who were so small back then. And now they're teenagers, right? They're 19, 17, and 16 now. And I got a credential, right? That could help me with my career. So like, that's what I did. And again, it's probably not the easiest thing. Way to get out of consulting, but it worked very well for me. And so that was my off ramp. Like, I'm going to totally stop traveling, get lots of time with, these humans that I helped to, create, actually help raise them. And then build up something that, to this day, still helps me with my career. So. Yeah.
And I think you mentioned this earlier, right? Like, where your area of interest is like on the intersection of technology and business, right? And I think that a lot of people in tech, they recognize like, oh, like I know the tech side pretty good, but the business side, maybe I don't care about as much. Maybe it takes me a little bit away from tech, but like I'm very similar. Like, I want to be like right in the middle. I want to be that, not to take your, key. I like being that translator in the room. So, how is the MBA helped you kind of navigate this world of technology, knowing that at the end of the day, like the more accurately you can help solve business problems, the more successful you're going to be in tech, right? Because that's all it really boils down to, is like, how does technology use as a tool to make companies money or help organizations run more optimized way, right? Like, how has it helped you?
Yeah. So let me explain. I think most people know this, but like an MBA is a master's level degree where you're able to get exposed to all the business functions, right? So there's finance, there's marketing, customer support, accounting, general management, etc. I had an MIS component as well, which is how businesses use technology, which I really enjoyed. And what that gave me was a holistic view of what you do as a business, just to be very obvious. And so what that helps me understand is when I'm building software for a company, one, like I'm able to understand the financials of the company that I work for, right? So I work for GitHub and we're owned by Microsoft. And so whenever Microsoft has their earnings calls, or I'm thinking about, okay, what does my team do? How does that tie to the goals, the financial goals, right? Because GitHub is a business that has financial goals, so is Microsoft. And can I draw a line between kind of what we do and those financial goals and then the goals of our parent company? And if not, then like I need to change that, right? And so very much when we think about annual recurring revenue, ARR, or monthly recurring revenue, all these different metrics, that, contribution margin, things like that, then like that's a language that I understand. And then I can help my team understand that, okay, here are the metrics that we run under. Whenever whatever company I work for announces, these are our themes that we're focusing on. They're almost always like business-based. We want to grow more customers, or we want to make customers more sticky, whatever it is. I can translate all of those business terms into, okay, let's think about what that means for us.
Yeah.
And I will say, as an engineering manager, that is part of my job. But I think that any software engineer, you are very much well served by doing this, because look, I understand, and I've worked with amazing engineers, like who are very advanced, very good, who are still in the, like, I don't want to think about the customer. I want to think about the thing. Just tell me what you want to build and I'll build it. Right. And again, that kind of archetype, I think like there's probably a path if you're really good and doing that. But I think that the type of engineer that often gets retained when times get hard, or when you need to solve hard problems, they're going beyond just solving problems in code. They're understanding the customers. They're understanding what is the financial and business benefit of the work that we do. How do we deliver more value to our customers? Those are the, and these titles vary by company, but in general, like those are the staff engineers, principal engineers, distinguished engineers who can do more than just write well-crafted code that's fit for purpose. They understand the business context and the framework that we all write code for.
Yeah.
And then those are the people I think that have way more longevity in their careers, and I think they're able to bring more impact to their companies. And so that's kind of what I do as an engineering manager. And I do encourage engineers, and again, it's not going to be for everybody, but if you can learn more about these business concepts and map them to your work, you're way better served in how you manage your career. And you really are you can make a bigger contribution to your company.
So I'm just going to say something, you know, as you were talking, I did a little right. The amount of times you use the word manager or mentoring or people, you said it like 7 times.
Right.
So I want to talk a little bit about that. Like sure. The idea of like, you know, at some point in time, like obviously you were an individual contributor and then you realized that you had a passion or an interest in helping individual contributors be more successful. And you're talking about, you know, the MBA kind of sets you up for success in learning the business, right? Which is, I think, something that, as you're an individual contributor, you mentioned that, like, it's not as essential. It's very, very helpful. But usually it's the responsibility of a manager in a lot of cases to translate the work that an individual computer is doing to how it relates back to the business. When did you realize that you wanted to be a people manager?
Wow. Yeah. I would say... This decision, and I'm just going to be very honest here, this decision was kind of forced on me. In that, at least when I was at Anderson Consulting, Accenture now, it was very much up or out, right? So you came in as an analyst, you spent a few years doing that, you're promoted to consultant, few years doing that. All this is kind of IC work. But then at around maybe the 5, 6, 7 year mark, like that's you're kind of going for like manager.
Yeah.
And then above manager, it's like senior manager. And then there's like, I think it was over senior manager. Then you go all the way up to like partner.
Yeah.
And like, if you're not hitting those promotion points, you
get
are advised.
Here. Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I, yeah. Get
you
out
were
of here.
What's
yeah.
called, like, you know, counseled out. Like you were given, and they did it like kind of maybe in a, I mean, they generally you weren't outright fired, but you were highly encouraged to go somewhere else to be successful, right? So my journey to being a manager was very much like, that's kind of what I needed to do to keep working at Accenture, right?
Sure.
But I will say that that was something that unlocked a part of me that I probably didn't recognize year 3 through 5 of my career, which is I love people. I love people management. I love the aspect of not just helping these humans who all have great backstories and needs and things that I hope that I can help them with, but not only help them deliver software, but help them see things in themselves that they may not see, to help them accomplish certain things that may have taken them longer, but to help them get in some ways out of their own way. Like that to me is a part of my job that I love. Like I love shipping code. I love delivery. I love all of that, but I really get geeked out about the people manager thing. And so I remember very much getting promoted to manager at Anderson Consulting and getting my first team and trying to figure out, okay, I got to go from managing my work to managing all of this other work and then having to navigate that leap and all that. But I would say now, like this was very much not like some kind of binary step function, like I am now a people manager and I'm here to help all the people. It was an analog, very messy, fuzzy thing. But over time, I realized that, you know, if I go back to being an IC, then I might be like a good engineer. But I think that my contribution to this industry is maybe helping 7 or 8 other people become good engineers and maybe even becoming better than I could be. And I think that I found that was my rock that I wanted to live in the wall of our industry. And that was my contribution. And that's really what made it work for me.
I mean, so, and we said this a little bit before we got started, like I've been a fan of this, you know, following on social media and hearing you talk about things, and I've seen you speak, and it just seems to me like, and this is going to be an oversimplification of things, but it seems like you get it. Like you understand what it takes, not just to be like a successful person in tech, but also just a successful person in general. Like we all, like you were saying a few things that stood out to me. It's like fitting you know, the things that people do, making sure that they're aware of the things they do well and the things they don't do well and how we can fix them, or not fix them, but how we can kind of course correct to make them a bit more successful. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've seen you talk about specifically, and I've seen you, you know, in a couple of different modalities talk about it, is like this idea of like managing burnout. And, you know, so like, I want to talk about that because for one, I think you have a great mechanism for talking about burnout. And I think you have a really strong opinion on burnout and how we can manage. I'd love to talk a little bit about that, especially from the lens of talking with ICs when, again, like the work, just here's the work, here's the burn down, here's the sprint log, here's the spikes, all these things, right? And eventually just becomes work, and the work never stops, especially like at a company like GitHub, right? Like the work is never going to stop. You're never done. So how do we help ICs or people in general in tech recognize that and not just pass out at their keyboards?
Yeah. Thank you so much. You're very generous. I don't know if I get it. I think I am getting it right in my career.
Growth mindset. Yeah. Growth mindset.
Yeah. And so, so like one, it was recognizing that burnout is very real. It's recognizing I've been burned out. It's recognizing that this industry is one that is challenging by itself. Like if you froze the industry in amber and just didn't change it, it would be very stressful. But then you have the fact that there's all these things happening. I mean, Kubernetes wasn't a thing when I started my career at Accenture. Yeah. I mean, we had like Microsoft virtual machines and, you know, we could like have these machines that we could like put on a desk and carry around like that. I thought that that was really cool. But like now with like containers and all that, this came way much later. Of course, AI being this new thing that's really transforming our industry. So you have all these constant shocks about, okay, how can I keep up with like the latest language or the latest framework or the latest way of like deploying code or, you know, all these now AI helpers and all that. And so I think like that's another part of the burnout. And the stress, I think that the way, and again, all this is through hard knocks, the school of hard knocks.
Sure.
I realized that there had to be a better way, that as I paid the price of burnout, of not managing my stress, as my wife, who's a college professor, you know, she's a bona fide PhD, brilliant person, very accomplished, but also, and this goes along with accomplishment often, very burned out, we began to get a framework for how do we tackle this, right? So we did research and found out that, you know, hey, spoiler alert, burnout's rampant, especially in software. But what's a common sense, lightweight framework, and I won't go into all the detail, into managing the stress that can lead to burnout. We call it building burnout resistance, right? Because you really can't go down to zero burnout. You can resist burnout, but it's probably never gonna go away. It's kind of a big part of what we think. And so it's all about relationships, focus, and health, right? And we find that by having healthy relationships and investing in making them healthier and having a focus and managing all the distractions that we have from Twitter and Threads and Snapchat and TikTok and Netflix and all this, and then focusing on our health. And it's really the thing like getting enough sleep, staying hydrated, eating as well as you can, moving as much as you can, that's a very simple framework, right? If we guard our hearts, our minds, and our relationships and our focus, then we found, and I found this to be very much the case, that I'm more burnout resistant when I do that. And so like, that's the framework. We can go into more detail if you want, but I think as a manager, this framework has been very helpful in me understanding, okay, this person who I care about, who I'm responsible for supporting, seems to be going through something. And like, you know, I do say, you know, never as a manager say you've seen burnout, right? You don't want to diagnose people.
Yeah.
But you can talk about what you've observed and then you can slowly begin to build that part of your relationship and then help give them time, tools. And like one of the biggest tools is time off. I do monitor the time that my folks take because they should probably take more than they're comfortable taking.
Sure. Yeah.
And being someone where it's like, you know, I don't think I in the past, easily 5 years, I've never denied a vacation request, but being that person that understands what helps people thrive, what helps people become more burnout resistant, is very much tied into my manager style.
I'm going to say something, and I don't mean it to be pointed in any way, because it's a compliment. You just talked about something like this burnout. It doesn't correlate directly to tech, right? So burnout is not a tech thing. I think burnout is a human condition thing. And I'd love to get your thoughts is like, you know, you could like for what it's worth, Anwan and his wife, they do a workshop on burnout specifically. And if you have the opportunity to attend, I highly recommend it. Like it.
I do.
And so one of the things that I find very fascinating about the idea of burnout specifically is that it's usually not the directly the work that burns you out. It's all the extenuating circumstances related to the work or the outside things that you have zero control over that drift into the work. Mm-hmm. And none of those things have to be tech related. So I'd love to get your thoughts on, you know, just take tech out of the picture and burnout in burnout in general. What are some of the things that you've recognized with yourself that you that have tapped into? Hey, Anwan, maybe you're having a bit of burnout at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I think that you're exactly right that burnout's not just about tech. I mean, the literature shows that across multiple industries. And, you know, if you go back, especially to the pandemic, right? And then the increased levels of what we were all going through. I think it's gotten a little bit better since then, but still at a high level. And I will give a short sidebar in that I do think some of the reasons that I focus on tech, beyond the fact that it's my chosen industry, is that people don't understand that. Well, y'all sit in like these $800, $2,000 chairs in temperature controlled rooms on this ergonomic keyboard with like big monitors, right? I have like 1, 2, 3, 4 monitors around me right now. Like, why y'all burn out, right? It's like, let's talk about it, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, and it's the change element, right? Because I mean, unlike being a CPA or working in construction where these industries haven't really changed that much, we have this ever ongoing need to keep up, right? So that what makes tech special. But putting tech to the side, I think that part of what's happened to us and us being society over the past decade at least, which has made us more susceptible to burnout, is just the loss of connection, right? I mentioned earlier that we have the world at our fingertips, right? Where when I was a kid, if I wanted to learn more about Tokyo, I had to take a bound set of dead trees and go to the volume with the T in it and then go to the Tokyo section. And honestly, probably that page when it was printed months before I got it was probably already obsolete and out of date.
Yeah.
But, and now we have like Wikipedia. I can get on a live feed and watch Tokyo, you know, right now if I wanted to. With all that access to information and all the social media, where I have some, you know, thousands of people connected to me across my social graph, like we were more disconnected than ever. Mm-hmm. And I think that social media, which, you know, honestly was not really made to connect people, was made to monetize people's interest and connection, just to be honest. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't made for that, it gives us empty calories of connection. And so we think that we're connected, right? I may go, I might get on Twitch and live stream myself, you know, beating that, you know, area of Baldur's Gate, or I may get on Twitch and, you know, figure out, walk people through getting through this other game. And I have all these people viewing me or all these people retweeting what I say or liking what I say. But we don't get all of the, like your brain doesn't recognize that as connection. Right.
Yeah.
There are certain things that the brain does. Like if you were, I mean, we're connecting now, but if you were and we're in the same room, you were across the table from me, like physically here.
Sure. Yeah,
my brain and your brain would it would secrete certain chemicals that only happen when someone's in the room with you.
Yep.
That would make the connection more real. And because we don't have that, because we are so isolated, especially during the pandemic, but even now, and we have all these fake connections. I think that's a big reason why people across the world are so susceptible to burnout. In my experience, if you read the literature, relationships lubricate stress. Mm. And without those relationships, you grind the gears. And that's why as an introvert, by the way, I've heavily invested. And I'm a classic going, people are like, well, you're staged in front of 800, 1,000 people. Like, yeah, but like, I'm drained by, you know, my energy. I energize in solitude and being alone, but I live a life and have a job where I'm around people and I love the people part, but I'm drained by it. But like, even as an introvert, like I throw myself into human connection because like, that's where the life is. That's where the healing is. And I think without doing that, we will continue to have a hard time with burnout.
Yeah. So you said something that resonates so well with me. So, and it just reminded me, because I had a conversation with my therapist about, like, you were talking about being in the same room with people. And, you know, my therapist mentioned, like, you know, when you're close to someone, your heart rates will get closer to the same beats per minute. Your breathing will connect in some way. Like, you'll be breathing at the same cadence. And you don't get that if you're not in the same room with someone. Because, like you said, the chemicals that come, you know, that secrete from your body, as gross as that sounds, like, they're creating that connection, that sense of community, right? Another thing that I find interesting about burnout, and I'd love to kind of talk about this specifically as we wrap up, is like, there's also a lot of noise in the world. You mentioned something about how burnout is kind of like, especially in tech, has gotten, I mean, not worse is not the best way to phrase it, but it's definitely been accelerated, right? And you used a couple of practical examples of like other industries where there hasn't been as much change.
Yeah.
When you talk about burnout and when you talk about just the amount of information that, like we talked about, that Wikipedia, looking at thousands of Twitch streams, social media, like, what are some things that we can do to tune out the noise? Because I can't speak for you or anybody else, but I can only speak for myself. Like, I'm in front of a computer 8 to 10 hours a day. I'm on my phone unhealthily another couple of hours a day. Like, I'm just consuming so much information. And most of it, I can't remember what the phrase is, but there's something that your brain does when you see something that your brain doesn't care about, and it just throws it away immediately. Like, an classic example is like cars driving down the street. If your brain tried to process every color of a car that drove by you, it would like get exhausted immediately, right? Yeah. There's so much noise. And I think if you're trying to tune in and pay attention, it's extremely exhausting. So other than the completely rational but impossible thing of like, oh, don't be on your phone as much, or try not to be in front of a computer as much. Like, what are some of the things that we can do, and not to steal from the great content that you and your wife are doing around burnout, like, what are some of the things that people can do to, one, identify that they're falling victim to too much noise, but also some of the ways to remedy it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, right? I mean, to your point, our brain does try to tune out everything, because if you're taking on information, then you just literally cannot function. It's overloaded, right? You know, everyone, if you're watching here, you know, I assume that you have a nose, right? And if you look, you see your nose all the time, right? If you look, but your brain ignores it, right? If you look, you see, oh, I can see my nose right now. But my brain tunes it out, right? Because it's like, I need to see what's in front of me so that that cheetah or that lion doesn't eat me, right? I can't focus on my nose. I got to focus like on the horizon, right? So we're constantly trying to tune out in order to optimize living and optimize survival. I'm going to just give a resource. So Deep Work by Cal Newport is a great book on this. And Cal goes into way more detail than I have now. But like, one simple thing that I can encourage the people watching this to do, if you hopefully live in a safe area, but find a loved one, whether that's your partner, your spouse, a friend, someone in your area, and go for a walk, a couple blocks at least, and don't take your phone. Both of you, leave your phone at home and just be present.
Yeah.
Be in nature, be outside, be with the person that you're walking with. Talk about your day. I've been this person, right? Two people taking a walk, everyone's looking at their phone, you know, not connecting. But like, that simple thing, which, you know, probably if you cannot do it every day, try to do it like 3 or 4 times a week.
Put a schedule around it.
Yeah, put a schedule, put it in your phone, right? Put it in your phone, then put your phone down.
Put a calendar invite in your phone to put your phone down. That's great. I love it.
Exactly, right? If you bring your watch, if you have like a smartwatch, an Apple Watch, you can count your steps and all that on it, whatever. But like, you get a few benefits. One, you get nature, you get oxygen, you get you, and hopefully there are trees and grass around wherever you, if you're watching this, lives. You're able to connect to a human without distraction. You're probably going to notice things around your neighborhood that you don't. I didn't know there was a playground there. Yeah. Oh my goodness! Like this. There's a coffee shop on the corner. We walk past there every day. Didn't know. And like that simple practice is how you begin to repair your attention. And by doing that, you'll be able to connect more to the person you're with, connect more with the outside world. And like that simple practice by doing it, then you can begin to explore, okay, what other ways can I tune things out? What other ways can I remove distraction to focus on just being, right? So
That's great. I'll even add one additional thing. As somebody who works from home and unfortunately, like if I'm not going to the gym or going to the office once a month maximum or going with my wife to the grocery store, I don't leave the house very much. So the amount of times that like that my wife and I have been driving and I'm like, wait, they're building houses here? Because I live in an area where like they're building houses constantly. And you I know where you live ish, right? And they're always building houses there too, right? Oh, yeah. So like I'm like, wait, they're building houses here? And my wife will be like, yeah, they've been building houses there for like 6 months. And I'm like, oh, I gotta get out of the house more. Right? So it's crazy to think like something as simple as just going for a walk can just completely like change the chemistry of your brain if you do it consistently, right? And then you do it for like, what is it, the 27 or 28 days, and then it becomes a habit, and then it becomes something that is built into your regimen, your routine. And then when you don't do it, you're like, oh, I gotta go for a walk like real bad, right? Yeah, so I mean, plus, there's great health benefits just walking in general, which absolutely. I mean, so I'm going to take that advice from you. Like, I'm going to say, hey, you know, hey, wife, because that's how I talked to my wife. I said, hey, wife, let's go for a walk and not bring our phones. And I highly recommend to take Anwan's advice. I imagine your partner will probably initially be a bit confused because if you're not already doing it, right? So be like, hey, I listened to this podcast and this really smart person said I should do this. So I'm going to try to do it. And I can't imagine somebody saying, no, I don't want to walk with you for 15 minutes unless like, and then there's a different problem going on.
I think most will go with it.
Yeah. This conversation has been so great. I really appreciate the time just talking a lot about one, getting to know how you got started and kind of, you know, not career progression per se, but learning how it, you know, you're starting in tech and learning about tech and how it kind of shaped you into the individual you are today, where, you know, you have the amazing ability to translate not just like things that don't make sense to everybody, but put them in ways that actually are practical and approachable for folks. And, you know, this has been a great conversation. One of the things that I love to ask my guests at the end, you know, we've been talking for a little bit over an hour about how you got started and, you know, your opinions on different things, which I agree with a lot. And I think that they're very respected opinions. If you talk to people in the industry, like if you can kind of summarize the conversation we've had, but you only had a word or two to do it, what would that word be for you?
I think can give the word and then maybe explain the word a little
bit. Of course. You make the rules, man. You can do whatever you want. I've had people that just talk like, and yeah. So like, I mean, I'm not going to like mute your microphone if you say more than three words. Right. Yeah.
I would say connection is the word that I would use. And I say that in that most of the people in software development, especially, like we want to leave our mark. Maybe we want to create that next front end framework that everyone uses, or that next library that people use. And it's, you get 5% more compression than using whatever people are using now, or you want to be known for building this open source project, and all that's great. But almost anything that you make in our industry will be obsolete at some point. Everything you build, every product that you can build, it may be hot for a moment, but at some point it will have zero users.
Yeah, you're being risky, man. Like you talked about JavaScript frameworks, that doesn't even have that long. Like,
I mean,
yeah. If I interrupt, as you continue.
Exactly. But one thing that you can do to have an impact and to put your name on something is the connection that you make with others.
Yep.
Especially for the managers out there. I have people who manage me, who invested in me, and those returns are still paying out, yeah. Right? I mean, I've even talked to these people in like a decade or two, but they enriched my life because they cared
yep.
to connect with me. So I encourage anyone watching this, whether you're an individual contributor, to connect with your coworkers, connect with the people around you, connect with the people you care about as well, especially for managers. If you're in software, invest in connection and leaving that positive impact on people, not just the product, that positive impact on people, because that will pay out over a lifetime.
Yeah, I can't say anything to that. That was perfect. This has been great, N1. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me. This has been, I selfishly said, like, I say this to all my guests, and I said to you before, like, I'm very selfish in that I take this hour to like try to change my chemistry a bit and think about things a bit differently. And I think I've learned a lot from you, and I really appreciate it. For folks that highly, if you're not already doing this, you need to follow N1 across all different social media platforms. First off, like, the fact that you just got your first name, you can find him on Twitter or X at N1, A-N-J-U-A-N. The fact that you've gotten that everywhere, man, like, that's kudos to you, man. That's great.
It's a new nickname.
Yeah. Yeah, and there'll be some links also to some other places that you can find N1 or some things that he's been working on, and I highly recommend doing so. So before we sign off, my friend, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Isaac, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed our time together.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for tuning in live as well as listening in the future. This is Isaac Levin from Coffee and Open Source, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.
Take care, y'all.